Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. At least 56 people were killed and more than 200 injured when an apparent suicide bomb ripped through the parking lot of a crowded park in the Pakistani city of Lahore. That's where Christians were celebrating Easter Sunday, according to officials. Dozens of ambulances were seen racing to the park, which is situated near the center of the city. Many are women and children among the dead and wounded. Meanwhile, the army has been called in, according to a top Lahore administration official, and added that soldiers were at the scene helping rescue operations. A senior police official said the blast appeared to be a suicide attack, adding that ball bearings were found at the crowded park. Belgian riot police, meanwhile, fired water cannons Sunday to disperse far-right football hooligans who disrupted mourners at a shrine for victims of the Brussels attacks. In scenes that compounded a week of grief for Belgians, black-clad protesters shouted anti-immigrant slogans and moved in on a makeshift memorial at the Place de la Bourse, where hundreds of people had gathered in a show of solidarity. The clashes between the far-right demonstrators and police underscored the tensions in Belgium after Tuesday's Islamic State suicide attacks. Military chiefs from 39 countries met Sunday in Riyadh for talks on the Saudi-initiated International Anti-Terrorism Coalition. Saudi Arabia announced that coalition in December, saying it would share intelligence, counter violent ideology, and deploy troops if necessary to combat extremists. Several members of the group, including Saudi Arabia, are part of the U.S.-led coalition bombing the Islamic State group in Iraq and Syria. This is VOA News. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu defended the Israeli army Sunday as controversy gripped the country over a soldier caught on video shooting a Palestinian assailant in the head as he lay on the ground. The issue reportedly sparked a bitter argument behind closed doors at the Israeli government's weekly cabinet meeting Sunday. Thursday's shooting led to the soldier's arrest and saw strong condemnation from military officials. Several hundred Iraqis and Syrians at the Idomeni border camp stood between protesters and police on Sunday, thwarting the protesters' efforts to march toward the fence separating Greece from Macedonia. Scuffles broke out there between the two groups. The protesters twice broke through the barrier the Iraqis and Syrians had formed, only to be pushed back by Greek riot police who used only their shields. People speaking for the Iraqis and Syrians, including Kurds from both countries, have told police that they were not taking part in Sunday's protest and that the protesters are from Afghanistan and Pakistan. They also say that activists were circulating at the camp Saturday, urging people to join them. Syrian government forces, meanwhile, backed by Russian airstrikes, have recaptured all of the iconic historic town of Palmyra from the Islamic State forces. Edward Uranian has details for VOA from Cairo.
A Syrian army spokesman claimed victory for government forces on state TV. He says that Syrian military forces backed by Russian and government warplanes have succeeded in restoring peace and security to the town of Palmyra and surrounding areas following wide-scale operations, killing many Islamic State fighters and destroying their weaponry. Rami Abdulrahman, who heads the opposition Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, told Arab media that he believes the Islamic State group is still resisting in some parts of the city. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Qatar's state-funded broadcaster Al Jazeera Sunday announced a fresh round of job cuts, with around 500 positions being lost, most of them at the network's Doha headquarters. In total, the job cuts will reduce Al Jazeera staff numbers from around 5,200 to 4,000. French Prime Minister Manuel Valls said Sunday that the European Championship soccer tournament will go ahead as planned, despite the attacks in Paris last November and Brussels last Thursday. He spoke on French state television and said that the strongest answer to terrorism is the, in addition to the deployment of all intelligence and security members, is life. More details on this and more at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA. We'll be right back.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
We offered the flag bearers and their running mates police protection. And we just did not offer. We also gave them the opportunity to make an input.
Ghanaian police to provide protection to all presidential candidates and their running mates ahead of the November 7 general election.
It's awesome. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And then the Bible comes alive for you. I mean, you read it in the United States, you go to church, but now you actually know what it was like and can see it.
Christians in many parts of the world celebrate Easter.
The ADF is not really what people make it out to be. It's not this foreign Islamist force. It's a force that is much more rooted in local society. And the second conclusion, that it's not just the ADF, but also others involved in the massacres.
And a new report on Eastern Congo says massacres of civilians since late 2014 are not only the work of Ugandan Islamist rebels. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Ghanaian police will protect all presidential candidates and their running mate as part of planned security measures in the run-up to the November general election. Serfaz Arthur, Director of Public Relations for the Ghana Police, says this will be a repeated measure by the police after similarly providing security for presidential candidates in the 2012 general election. Arthur also told me that media reports that recent pronouncements by politicians are increasing tension and could spark possible electoral violence during the presidential, parliamentary, and local elections are inaccurate.
It is a repetition of what we did in 2012. As part of the security arrangements that the National Election Security Task Force put in place to deliver the election in 2012, we offered the flag bearers and their running mates police protection. And we just did not offer. We also gave them the opportunity to make an input in police officers that we're assigning to them. And that is what we are bent on repeating this year, because we realized that that action worked to perfection.
We heard reports that some Ghanaians are complaining about tension in the country because of some pronouncements of some politicians. What is the move here?
I wouldn't say there is tension in the country as a result of political pronouncements. I would rather say people are expressing their views, people are venting their concerns, and that is akin to democracy.
What is the cooperation between the police and the Electoral Commission ahead of the election, and what are the preparation mechanisms that the police would want to establish ahead of the election?
There's something in place we call the IGP's dialogue with the stakeholders to the election. And as part of it, a lot of activities have been lined up. The first was the meeting between the Inspector General of Police and his administration and the youth leadership of the various political parties. And just a day after that, the police administration met the leadership of the NDC, the ruling National Democratic Congress, and also gauged their feeling and engaged in a very frank discussion of the election. A week after that, the IGP once again met with the leadership of the MPP, the New Patriotic Party, and discussed or held a similar discussion with them. And immediately after the Easter holidays, we have lined up meetings with the rest of the political parties. In fact, the IGP did indicate that we are likely to meet each of the stakeholders more than twice before the elections, because he wants to hold constant and continuous dialogue with them to jointly find out amicable, the right and the best means of ensuring a peaceful election. And I can mention the EC, the media, the chiefs, the clergy as part of this larger scheme that we have in place to hold dialogues with the various stakeholders.
You are aware that on social media platforms, there were reports of some people bringing some ammunition into the country. What assurances will the police give Ghanaians to ensure a peaceful environment for the election?
Yeah, thank you. I can assure them from the point of the police and the sister security agencies that we are on the ground. We are all set to ensure that there's a peaceful election and that the instance that you cited and a few ones that we have in our records, whereby people who attempted to commit one criminal activities or the other were found out and arrested, indicate that our intelligence is up to the task, and that we are on top of our job, and that we are prepared to do our best. Except that the public has a duty in this. The public also has a role to perform. By being vigilant, taking pieces of information and passing them on to the police to ensure that we're able to assess them and together with the public ensure a peaceful election.
Serfaz Arthur is the Director of Public Relations for the Ghanaian Police. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. Christians in many parts of the world are celebrating Easter. The holiday marks what Christians believe is the day of the resurrection of Jesus. In the Holy Land, festivities took place amid Israeli-Palestinian tensions, as we hear from Robert Berger in Jerusalem.
Till on that cross, as Jesus died, the wrath of God was satisfied.
Easter dawned in Jerusalem with a sunrise service at the Garden Tomb, a holy site said to resemble the burial place of Jesus according to biblical accounts. Pilgrims from around the world sang hymns of the resurrection facing an empty tomb carved into a rock. A few hours later, Easter Mass was celebrated at the nearby Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Priests chanted the Easter liturgy as a fragrant cloud of incense engulfed the ancient stone tomb where tradition says Jesus rose from the dead. Colleen Schulte is from the U.S. state of South Dakota.
It's awesome. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and then the Bible comes alive for you. I mean, you read it in the United States, you go to church, but now you actually know what it was like and can see it.
It was a sparse turnout this Holy Week in the wake of 6 months of Israeli-Palestinian violence. Jerusalem has been the focal point of unrest, and armed Israeli police and soldiers carrying assault rifles patrolled the streets. But Peggy Howe, who is from the U.S. state of Kansas, was not afraid to come.
Have you looked at the rest of the world? Even you look at the news back home, and you maybe don't see the presence of police as much as you see here, but you have the same issues all around the world.
She said that with terrorist attacks hitting Brussels, Paris, and the United States, Israel is as safe as anywhere else. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
A new report on Eastern Congo says massacres of civilians since late 2014 in Beni territory near the Ugandan border have not just been the work of Ugandan Islamist rebels, the ADF, as previously believed. As Nick Long reports for VOA from London, the findings may point to the need for a different approach to violence in the area.
Attacks on civilians in the Beni region have killed at least 550 people in the past 18 months. Congolese officials have placed the blame on the Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF, which has been characterized as a Ugandan Islamist movement. Yet a new report from the Congo Research Group says it may not be that simple. Jason Stearns, lead author of the report, agrees the ADF was partly responsible, but says the group was not working alone.
The first conclusion
conclusion being that the ADF is not really what people make it out to be. It's not this foreign Islamist force. It's a force that is much more rooted in local society. And the second conclusion, that it's not just the ADF, but also others involved in the massacres.
Researchers spent 6 months interviewing more than 100 people, including survivors of the attacks. The report cites various sources accusing local militias and members of the Congolese military. It says it's alleged that in some cases, men were promised up to $250 for each person they killed. As to who might have been paying them and why, Stern says his group is still working on that and has reached no conclusions. The authorities have arrested some individuals in the military for failing to take action against the ADF, but not specifically for involvement in the massacres, says Stearns.
Since the beginning of the massacres, there have been a few, I would say, very few individual arrests, again, mostly for inaction and not due to complicity. And I do not believe that any of them have actually been found guilty and those trials have gone through to their conclusion.
Local human rights groups suspect there may have been high-level complicity. Luis Saliboko is an activist in Oicha, a town near Beni. He says authorities can't say all the crimes were the work of the ADF alone. There was a sort of complicity, he alleges, because the ADF was able to operate with impunity. Saliboko and other local people say the killings sometimes happened close to military camps, but that soldiers ignored pleas to intervene and the killers walked away. Since mid-2015, the Congolese army has taken a more aggressive stance, and there has been increased fighting between soldiers and armed groups sometimes described as presumed ADF. A leader of civil society groups in the territory, Teddy Kataliko, says a thorough investigation is needed.
Nous demandons au gouvernement congolais qu'au-delà des campagnes militaires,
we call on the Congolese government, he says, to go beyond the military approach and to create a strong intelligence service so that the killers' networks can be dismantled and those collaborating with them brought to justice. Nick Long for VOA News, London.
Sudan's President Omar Hassan al-Bashir has threatened again to close his country's border with South Sudan. Sudan reopened the frontier in January after a previous shutdown in 2011. VOA East Africa correspondent Jill Craig in Nairobi spoke with economists and other experts about what another closure could mean for both countries.
Sudan is again threatening to close the border if South Sudan does not end what Sudan alleges is support for armed rebels. Sudan accuses its southern neighbor of backing conflicts in its Darfur region and in the Blue Nile and southern Kordofan states. South Sudan denies the allegations. James Alec Garong is a senior economist at the Ebony Center for Strategic Studies, based in Juba. He says a border closure would be financially disastrous for South Sudan.
Closing the border would even push South Sudan more down, and it's something unfortunate if they do. I hope they will not do.
Sudan previously closed the border in 2011, following South Sudan's secession, resulting in the South taking with it about three-quarters of Sudan's oil wealth. The U.S. Energy Information Administration estimates it to be 5 billion barrels of proven reserves. The border reopened in January, a move both countries anticipated would bolster financial ties. Talks are taking place to discuss the border and other issues. South Sudan agreed in 2012 to pay up to $25 per barrel for oil that traveled the pipeline from South Sudan to Port Sudan in Sudan, the only available route for export, but that agreement is expiring. South Sudan agreed to pay additional fees of $11 per barrel to use the pipeline, as well as another $15 per barrel to its northern neighbor in an attempt to compensate for lost revenues after South Sudan was created and split from Sudan. The arrangement was made when oil sold for more than $100 a barrel. South Sudan ultimately ended up losing on the deal when it agreed to introduce this fixed payment plan for use of the pipeline, instead of opting for a sliding scale linked to global prices. The country saw the agreement as a necessity at the time to gain its independence from Sudan. Alex Duvall is the executive director of the World Peace Foundation. He calls Bashir's newest threat part of very high-stakes bargaining between Khartoum and Juba over financial arrangements, which he believes is the real reason behind Sudan's threat.
Now the oil price has crashed, and South Sudan is in an extremely hard financial situation. In fact, it's on the brink of complete bankruptcy and hyperinflation. And in these circumstances, President Salva Kiir is absolutely desperate to get more money. And the only serious way in which he can get more money in order to pay his soldiers who are extremely hungry for cash is by signing a better deal with Northern Sudan. And President Bashir knows that extremely well, and he is using the threat of a border closure as part of his bargaining tactic.
This type of threat signals a greater impact on regional trade as well, according to economist and Nairobi-based Inter-Region Economic Network director James Shikwati.
You know, we're trying to look at integrated market in the Eastern Africa region. So it does not augur well when candidates that want to join the regional trade bloc are busy using borders as a leverage point to negotiate some aspects of what troubles them.
The International Monetary Fund estimates that South Sudan depends on oil for about 98% of its revenue. So the country quite literally cannot afford more disputes with its northern neighbor that could affect its oil income. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Last year, Cameroon celebrated news that it had been removed from a WHO list of countries at risk of exporting polio. No new cases have been reported in the country since the last outbreak in 2014. That could change at any time, though, because some families won't vaccinate their children. A Cameroon poet, himself a polio victim, has joined the campaign to silence the propaganda against polio vaccines. For VOA, Eugene Mfongwa reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
One evening in February, Douglas Achingale arrived early at a book launch in the Cameroon capital, Yaoundé. As he is introduced to give an academic critique of the work, two men help him to the podium. Achingale, who is one of Cameroon's leading poets, drags himself along with two wooden crutches. He lost both legs to polio when he was still a little boy.
My parents told me I caught polio before I was two. I was already walking, but was not vaccinated against polio. I started by limping slightly, and my mom thought I had stepped on a sharp object or something. As the days went by, the other leg also got affected, and I couldn't walk anymore.
Polio experts say if Achingale had been inoculated, he could have been spared. Polio is incurable, and vaccination is the only means of prevention. The disease, medically known as poliomyelitis, is caused by the poliovirus. It attacks the brains and muscles, crippling and sometimes killing its victims. An initiative led by the WHO has been trying to eradicate the disease. It hopes to deliver a polio-free world by 2018. 2 years ago, WHO said Cameroon was one of the few places still exporting poliovirus to other countries. It came after the country reported outbreaks in 2013 and 2014, which spread to Equatorial Guinea. Authorities responded with mass vaccination of children under five. Last year, the country gained polio-free status. No new case has been reported since 2014. But the gains are already under threat. Resistance against vaccination has again put thousands of children at risk. Achingale says that should not happen.
You know, it is really unacceptable, you know, for people to resist polio vaccination for their children. Absolutely outrageous. This is something people must accept for their kids. Living with polio is not easy at all. I miss things like playing football, dancing, which I so much relish.
Deniers claim the vaccine is bad and produces side effects such as sterility. Religious leaders often spread the rumors by telling their followers that vaccines are impure and evil. Susan Beng, who was vaccinated as a child, says the claims are false. At 35, she's healthy and has three children. She regularly vaccinates her own kids.
I and my husband received polio vaccines, but here we are. Nothing is wrong with us because our parents gave us polio vaccines. This talk about sterility is baseless.
Achingale is adding his voice to the effort to silence anti-vaccination propaganda. His poetry often addresses social and political themes of injustice and corruption. Increasingly, he's tackling disabilities.
There is a poem in my first collection, Oppression, which has disability as its main theme. The poem is titled The Wicked Staircase. It is true I have published only collections of poetry this far. But I don't write only poetry. I am currently working on a novel whose protagonist is a person living with disability.
Achingale says he is also working on a movie that will cast only people with disabilities. Authorities hope efforts like these will raise awareness and help the country stay polio-free. Reporting from Yaoundé, I'm Eugene Fongwa.
Storytelling and stand-up comedy are experiencing a renaissance in West Africa. The African Performing Art Jamboree, or MASA, in Abidjan this month showcased the talent of two performers who draw on their personal histories to produce dazzling one-woman shows. They are Tatiana Rojo from Ivory Coast and Rukiata Rodrigo from Burkina Faso. For VOA, Bram Postumus has their stories from Abidjan.
They are from West Africa. They both have wildly successful one-woman shows. And they are carving out their own niche in the theatre world, on and off the continent.
Bonjour à tous, je m'appelle Amutati, Tatiana Rojo.
Tatiana Rojo says she is from Ivory Coast and she works in the theatre and as a comedian. She has also been in 10 films since moving to France at age 19. Both Rojo and Burkina Faso native Rukiata Ouédraogo took the stage at the Abidjan Performing Arts Festival.
Bonjour, je m'appelle Rukiata Ouédraogo, comédienne, dramaturge.
Before the theatre, Ouédraogo did all kinds of different jobs to pay the rent. And then,
je suis allée faire un stage au Cours Florent, donc à Paris, et j'ai eu.
She says she wanted to try something new and did an internship at a theater in Paris. She says her teachers encouraged her, even though back in Burkina Faso, the theater didn't interest her at all. Tatiana Roja was always acting in other people's films, but then she decided she wanted to talk about her own life.
Avoir un spectacle comme ça au début, on a beaucoup de portes qui se ferment.
She says many doors slammed shut because she wanted to show the life of an unknown woman from Africa, someone like her mother. Nobody cared, she said. We had nowhere to perform. But then her stage director, Eric Checo, said, you know what? We're going to have your mother tell her story from a big, classic Louis XVIII royal French chair. And so was born her one-woman show, Dame de Fer, or Iron Lady. The antique chair is one of the few props she uses on stage. Rojo says her show, Dame de Fer, is about an Africa that fights. The mother marries off her girls because she needs to pay the rent and the bulldozer is on its way. Rojo says Africa sends its children abroad, but people have always moved around the world, and so Africa is no different. Ouédraogo is out to change the theatre.
Je parle effectivement de ça dans ma pièce, de mon combat.
She says she wants decent roles for black actors. It's always a cleaning woman, she says, or a nurse who works as an illegal migrant, or a prostitute. She says she's had it with all that. She refuses roles now because she has her own productions. Ouédraogo based her very first production on the life of Yenenga, the fierce legendary princess from what is now Burkina Faso. And both women gave their shows in Abidjan a distinctly Ivorian flair with a little Zouglou.
Le chien ne change jamais sa manière de s'asseoir. C'est qui ça? Kolo Kanga.
If you are in New York, keep an eye out for the debut of the English version of Tatiana Rojo's Iron Lady. And Rukiata Ouédraogo performs her newest production, Tombe la Masque, or Drop the Mask, at the Buffon Theatre in Paris throughout April. Bram Postumus for VOA News, Abidjan.
Next on Let's Talk. Social media. Are you a participant? Do you have an online account? Has it affected your life? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing social media. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports. And for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hello, Peter. And good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Africa Nightline Sports. Let's begin with the weekend 2017 Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. South Africa's Humpho Kekani scored an extraordinary goal from inside his own half, but it was not enough to give his side a win as they drew 2-2 with Cameroon. Tokelo Rantai put Bafana Bafana ahead after 17 minutes, with Sebastian Sayani equalizing for the hosts on the stroke of half-time. Kekana hit his wonder strike in the 50th minute, shooting straight into goal without a bounce, but Cameroon fought back again through Nicholas Nkwolu's header to make it 2-2. The result puts the indomitable Lions a point above Mauritania at the top of Group M. South Africa have an uphill task to qualify for Gabon 2017. They are third in the group, 5 points behind Cameroon. Also on Saturday, Hev Renner, who won the Nations Cup with both Zambia and Ivory Coast, watched his new Morocco side beat Africa's top-ranked nation, Cape Verde, 1-0. Senegal also maintained their perfect start to 2017 Africa Cup of Nations qualifying with a 2-0 win over Niger in Group K. Goals from Hamed Diame and Baye Omar Niese ensured that Senegal stay top of the group, 6 points ahead of the rest of the teams, who are all level on 3 points. DR Congo moved above Group B leaders Angola with a 2-1 victory in Kinshasa. Uganda were knocked off the top of Group D by Burkina Faso, who beat the Cranes 1-0 in Ouagadougou thanks to a Jonathan Pitroipa penalty. Uganda are second on the table, 11 points with Burkina Faso. Mauritius beat Rwanda 1-0 in Bellevue in their 2017 Africa Cup of Nations qualifier to record their second victory in Group H. Mauritius move up second in the group, 3 points behind Ghana, who beat Mozambique 3-1 on Thursday. In other qualifiers on Saturday, Namibia kick-started their bid for Gabon 2017 with a 3-1 win away to Burundi in Group K. Second-half goals from Benson Shilongo and Peter Shalulile put Namibia 2-0 in Bujumbura. The result lifts Namibia off the foot of the group to second, above Burundi on goal difference. Seychelles got their first victory in Group J, beating Lesotho 2-0 in Victoria. Seychelles are now level with second-placed Ethiopia, who lost 7-1 to group leaders Algeria on Friday night. Moving on to athletics, the Kenyan women repeated their 2014 feat at the IAAF World Half Marathon Championships by taking their first 3 places, as they did then in Copenhagen. Paris Chepchechee won the race in 1 hour 7 minutes and 31 seconds, with Limo second in 1 hour 7 minutes and 36 seconds, while Wacheri was third in 1 hour 7 minutes and 51 seconds. Kenya's women completed the second successive clean sweep of the podium, with Paris breaking away from pre-race favorite Cynthia Limo near the finish to take the title. Mary Wachera Ngugi was third. Before 2014, no country had secured all of the medals in the women's race at the IAAF World Half Marathon Championships. Kenya has now pulled off the feat twice in a row. In a race that was decided only on the final straight, Jepchechee added her name to the list of previous Kenyan winners with the title, joining the likes of Tegla Lalarop, Mary Kaitani, Florence Kiplagat, and Gladys Cherono. Cynthia Limo crossed the line 3 seconds behind Jepchechee, while 2014 silver medalist Mary Wasera followed 20 seconds after Limo. Meanwhile, Kenyan Godfrey Chamorro won the Men's World Half Marathon Championship in Cardiff in style in 59.09 minutes, beating Bernard Karioki Muchuri on Saturday. Chamorro defended the title he won in 2014. The 13.1-mile race around the streets of Cardiff involved tens of thousands of participants and some of the finest athletes on the planet. Mo Farah, double Olympic and world champion, struggled to match the magic of the Kenyans and could only bag bronze. Kamoro recovered from falling flat on his face at the start to retain his world half-marathon title in rain-swept Cardiff on Saturday. Kamoro and compatriot Bernard Karoki Muchuri, who kept up a rear world record pace throughout the race, were shoulder-to-shoulder approaching the final kilometer before Kamoro broke away to victory. Kamoro's race began in unfortunate style as he slipped over on the start line and was almost buried under a stampede of athletes before climbing back to his feet and continuing. He was quickly up with the leaders, though, and while the world record of 58.23 minutes was ultimately beyond him, in the atrocious conditions, his winning time of 59.10 was impressive. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to reflect and relax. A flashback with music from the continent.
Thank you for bringing this girl in my life.
And when you need me, girl, you know, send me, girl, always on time.
And girl, you need to know, for you, me go the extra mile.
And when the haters try to dish, you don't say nothing, just smile.
Why? Late nights, blackberry golden. Yeah. Now, baby, love, I am the one you should be holding.
Yeah.
Late nights, blackberry golden.
Yeah.
With every message, girl, my heart is unfolding.
If you tell me you will stay tonight, somebody can love you better out. I'll be your groupie. You're my star and the queen of my area. If you tell me you will stay tonight, nobody can love you better. If you won't meet my mama, oh, baby, why by me low? You call me like, say, I didn't press. I'm gonna give you too much. Make me say,
them view me flow.
Me flow.
I wanna make you mine.
You mine.
Cause I feel you die. I'm feeling the way that you rocking, girl. No deny, no stopping, girl. Me and you to the top, we rolling. Boys keep calling, but you keep them wanting. Hey, I, you can have whatever you like. Baby girl, please be mine. I get you everything that you like.
you too much. Maybe say, yeah, I say, yeah, I say, yeah, I say, yeah, I say. Likes it when I stay. She says she don't want me to go. She says I always make her day. Girl, would you be my love for now? She says she really likes my style. Seems like she wants to take it slow. Do anything to make her smile. Girl, would you be my love for now? What am I to do? Tired of running around chasing you. I can never think of replacing you. It's not you I define, baby, make up your mind. Hey, would you be my lover? Or love for four. This guy is feeling it in my soul. So would you be my lover now? I'm doing things I've never done. I'm giving all I have to give. I'm feeling like I found the one. Say you'll be my lover, please. What am I to say? Tired of running around, no delay. Make you no go look who your face. All this time you there waste, you gon' make me crazy. Would you be my lover? Catch it cruise. Wanna know if you go do. I got one question for you. Are you gonna let me be the one? Are you gonna let me be the one? Are you gonna let me be the one? Baby, oh.
Oh, That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Sadly, we are witnessing once again multiple terrorist attacks in the Belgian capital, Brussels, at the airport and at the subway. Since then, there has been blanket and massive coverage on television. Every aspect of the incident is being analyzed. Loopholes are being discussed and efforts made to close them. Now, all this is well and good, and we should commend the international community for its efforts. But the question is, Why this discrepancy when you have terrorist acts in other parts of the world, say, for example, in Africa, when you have hundreds and hundreds killed by Al-Shabaab, either in Somalia or in Kenya or other parts of East Africa, Boko Haram in Nigeria, in Cameroon, and other neighboring countries? Why is the coverage so tepid and only with heightened interest if European deaths are involved, as we have seen in the hotel in Mali and the recent killing on the beaches in La Côte d'Ivoire? We will leave it up to the psychologist to tell us why this double standard and this discrepancy. But we do know from history why there have been differences in reaction. In the cruder period of the 18th century and early 19th century, when Europeans were murdered in the far places of China and other parts of Asia, the whole of Europe was upset. And the reason given was that blood is thicker than water. In a more modern times, in the 1960s, when Ian Smith declared UDI, Unilateral Declaration of Independence, the world community awaited for the usual British swift action to put down the rebellion. But the then Prime Minister of Great Britain, Harold Wilson, in a moment of candor, announced that Britain would not use force to put down the rebellion in then Northern Rhodesia because those who have declared UDI are the kith and kin of the British people. But we now know that you cannot defeat terrorism by piecemeal. It has to be by a global approach. At the wake of 9/11, the President of the United States announced that America would attack all terrorists with a global approach. But that has changed. All terrorist groups are now connected. The known ones like ISIL and Al-Qaeda have their franchises in Africa, like Al-Shabaab or Boko Haram. So the global approach is compelling. Take the case of ISIL in Syria and Iraq, currently under heavy pressure from the Western coalition and Putin's Russia. They are losing real estate on a daily basis. Their finances are being depleted, and their leaderships are being killed. But ISIL is not sitting idly by. It has already stamped its feet in Libya. It is now firmly inserted in southern Libya, the homeland of Colonel Gaddafi. Now, if ISIL is defeated in Syria and Iraq, Europe may be under less pressure for terrorist acts. But the pressure will be on Africa, where ISIL will use his franchise to put excessive pressure on Africa, as is happening on a daily basis in and around Timbuktu. During the days of 1930s prior to the Second World War, Emperor El Selassie, as a lonely figure, spoke before the League of Nations and warned them that peace was indivisible because the major powers of the time did not respond adequately to the occupation of Ethiopia by Italy. The Security Council needed not only to pass a unanimous resolution on ISIL, but must have a resolution on defeating international terrorism, no matter where they are found, whether they are in Africa, in Europe, in Asia, and other parts of the world. Piecemeal approach would not do. And this is a pressing issue now before the international community. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, Justin Thwaites, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, even the fiercest leader in the world is overcome by sleep. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On World Water Day, March 22nd, the U.S. government, through the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, launched USAID Lowland Wash, a new water, sanitation, and hygiene activity to support the government of Ethiopia's One Wash national program in pastoral areas of Afar, Somali, and Southern Nations, Nationalities, and Peoples regions. The new activity will increase the availability of improved, sustainable drinking water sources, increase access to better sanitation products and services, catalyze enhanced sanitation and hygiene behaviors, and build capacity for enhanced knowledge and data management, while also expanding sustainable water use for agriculture. In the near term, the activity will help respond to the current drought while working to build long-term resilience by helping communities to better manage and use their water resources. Given the magnitude of the current drought, the activity will prioritize well rehabilitation in acutely affected Kabelis. This, in addition to the nearly $10 million in humanitarian aid that the U.S. is providing to improve access to safe drinking water, rehabilitate water systems and sanitation infrastructure, and provide relief items like hygiene kits and water containers. Ethiopia has made dramatic strides over the last 15 years to increase access to improved water and sanitation. Speaking ahead of the launch, Christian Holmes, Global Water Coordinator for USAID, highlighted the importance of the work the new activity will undertake. Safe water and sanitation is what enables a child to grow, learn, and rise out of poverty. It is what keeps communities healthy. USAID's lead partner, AECOM International Development, will implement the $23.8 million activity in cooperation with CARE USA and the International Rescue Committee. Water is life, and the United States is proud to partner with Ethiopia in developing this essential resource for the benefit of all the people of Ethiopia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.